Redwood Soundwave.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Matt and today I'm joined by a very special guest, my father, Matt Mason Sr., to talk about Them, the 1954 American black and white monster movie about giant ants. So hello, Dad. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well. We just watched this movie. I'm currently sitting at your kitchen counter, so... We've mentioned you on the podcast lots of times before when talking with Zach, of course, but it's fun to finally have you here and to talk about this movie. So my first question is, what got you into horror movies to start with?
It was just an avenue for us to do something. And when I was young, we would watch the late night spook shows and it was the traditional Universal monsters. Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman, Creature from the Black Lagoon, once it hooks you when you're young, then it just stays with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And Them is, of course, a movie that you and I have watched since I was very, very young, the Big Bug movie.
Yeah.
Which, of course, now Finn, my nephew, your grandson, watches quite a bit too, but... We have a lot of giant monster movies and a lot of giant insect movies. Where do you think that this film rates amongst the giant insect movies or the giant monster movies?
From my point of view, from the 50s, it's definitely the top for me. I just think it's the best.
Yeah. Is there anything about this movie in particular that keeps you coming back to watch it? I mean, we probably watch this, once a year at least?
Yeah, at least I watch it maybe a couple times a year. Yeah.
So. Yeah. So what is it about the giant insect or the giant monster movies that you think is, one, effective in the horror genre, and two, what is fun about it?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the storyline a lot of times, but also... there's a lot of nostalgia in it, particularly the shows that have the big monsters or the giant creatures or the giant insect, and you have the military fighting them. When I was growing up, it was always, that's the way the military looked. They were green men, and that's the way they are in this movie and a lot of the movies that were in the 50s and 60s. So we played with the little soldiers that were the little green men, and these movies, that's what we should see, is the little green men, and they're fighting the monsters. And so I can kind of relate to that.
Yeah, and it is exactly like the way that you would play with toys, which is you right. have the little green men toys, and then you'd have like a Godzilla toy or yeah. some sort of other creature toy that, to scale, would be much larger than them. So this is kind of... putting together two of the ways that we would think about toys, but did they ever make any Them toys? Can you remember any?
No, I can't remember any Them toys, or even for retro that where they came back and made something. I don't know of any.
Yeah, I can't think of any either. But the idea of behind this movie, of course, is giant insects, and there's always a science element behind this. We don't necessarily talk about this in the same breadth that we would talk about science fiction, but it is really a science fiction film because in many of these there is always kind of the eccentric scientist who is leading the charge or the one that is being asked for advice and finding those. And in this case we have the myrmecologist, Dr. Harold Medford, and his daughter, who are helping assist with the investigation into these insects. Would you say that this is a pretty early precursor to other science fiction films? Or do you think that it's kind of distinct?
It's distinct for me. I mean, I just kind of see the, the giant creature movies, you know, Tarantula, The Giant Claw, which was about a big bird that was really tough to battle. I don't know, I just kind of lump it in with all the other big bug movies.
Big bug movies, for sure. Yeah. So, you talked about plot lines. The plot line of this movie, it begins with young girl who is just sort of in a catatonic state, wandering, and she's found by local police officers and then brought back, and then we start to look for these giant ants, which the reason that they discover that there is some sort of giant ants is because they find a body full of formic acid, which is an excretion that ants produce. And then they go into these sewer systems to find the giant hives. But I want to ask, do you see any plot points in this movie that influenced movies that kind of came later? Or when you were watching modern horror films, do you ever think back to this movie in particular, like, oh, that's something that they did here first? Because I think of Eight-Legged Freaks, which is, of course, another entry in the giant insect,
right.
If you can call spiders insects, which I think there's a little bit of a deviation on there, and there's a little bit of suspension of belief, but they go into the mines in that movie, which is where the large nest is, and they have to blow up the mines. So that, I think, is incredibly indicative of the cultural impact that them and these 1950s black and white movies have on contemporary media and the longevity of them. Do you think, what do you think about that?
Well, I would agree. But for some reason, I don't look at it that way. I don't, when I watch, especially the newer movies, I don't usually see something that was in the older movies that I was watching, you know? So if it's like a horror movie like Frankenstein or something, you know, and it's a remake, then yeah.
You kind of
get it, but yeah, it's...
You treat them more as independent
right,
entries into those things. Yeah, I can absolutely understand that. And so with this movie, would you consider this a B-movie?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, what defines a B-movie to you?
I think it come from The Blob, because The Blob started with a B, so that was a B-movie. I don't know whether it was first or not. I don't think it was. I think it was after... them, but
often there's a budgetary restrictions that kind of go along
with
the
amount of money they're going to spend on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way that they have to go about creating the creature, we go back to kind of the Ray Harryhausen studio style and creating these large scale puppet works that they use. What do you know about this film? Was it puppet based or?
Actually, on one of the DVDs that I've watched, they have a bonus material, and it does show how they were controlling the ants with, they were large, I guess you would call them a puppet, and they were man-operated. They had men behind them with...
almost like Jurassic Park style, like they had...
They had board, you know, like big 2x4s that was moving the arms and things, yeah. So.
Oh, interesting. And they do a really good job, then, of obscuring that from view, because right. I think that that's one of the things that CGI and computer animation has been able to help with is creating the artifice of these characters that have a lot of mobility. But then with these older movies, they just didn't have that technology. So I think that that makes it even more impressive when you don't see the little strings working. And I think about like the old Godzilla movies where you can see the wires, or even... You know, the giant claw, which you said...
You can see the wires in giant claw.
You can see the wires.
Well, in the movie Them, that you never see the ant full on. You only see partials of the ants, like that half of an ant. And I think that's because of the puppetry or the mechanism that they're using to operate it.
Yeah, and we've done a couple of movies that include puppetry on the podcast before, but I think that especially with this one, there is such a specific artistic style that comes from the fact that they had to be able to come up with ingenious ways of hiding the physical motion of the puppets,
right.
Which the ants, the way that the ants move, it's slower than ants would normally move, but I think that that plays really well into some sort of scientific background. The sheer size of the ant, the exoskeleton would be so heavy that the ant would collapse in on itself, which is, that's kind of the way that the film and film at large helps protect us, is just like, oh, this is way beyond reality, but there is a slowness to the ant's movements that make it really clever in how they're able to hide the puppeteering and the mechanics of the movement.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. So, thinking about this movie, and just talking about this movie, how does this movie come up in your day-to-day life?
Well, I do see ants in the gardens and in the yard. I'm not for sure really how it comes up in day-to-day life, other than, you know, I enjoy science fiction and horror, so, you know, it's always there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this movie, for the purposes of the podcast, is really more interesting to me as a starting off point to talk with you about where you look at horror, because you are much more of the nostalgic horror kind of person. That's not to say that you don't enjoy modern horror, but your wheelhouse is especially in the Universal kind of monster era. What keeps you coming back to these 1950s and the B movies of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s?
For the enjoyment, but also, you know, every time I watch them, sometimes I see something new, or I see something, I'm looking for other things in the scene that I never saw before. So that's one thing. But it's just, a lot of it's just because I enjoy the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and especially, like, you and I, we have talked about this before, black and white has never sort of colored the way that we watch movies, right. But there are a lot of contemporary audience members who simply cannot watch black and white movies. Right. Why do you think that is?
I'm not for sure, but I know that my daughter, or your sister Erin, had a sleepover one night, and the kid said, "Can we please watch something that's not black and white?" Because all of our VHS tapes and DVDs back then we had the black and white horror movies, and so that's what they watched, and they didn't like it.
Yeah, and not to talk out of class with Zach not being here, but Zach is also a person who doesn't watch a lot of black and white horror, though I think that I have started to push him into that direction, because we've done now Frankenstein and we've done Nosferatu, and even A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is a black and white vampire movie that is a contemporary movie that was retroactively put into black and white. But I particularly find something comforting in the black and white films, because I find that it kind of further removes it from reality. So if you look at, like, contemporary horror, and a movie like The Strangers, which is a very realistic horror movie, the idea of a home invasion in general, one of the things that adds to it is the realism of the actual shooting locations, the scenes, the way that the film actually looks, versus these 1950s movies, which, because of their black and whiteness, detaches itself from reality even further, or makes it more of an entertainment experience rather than a horror experience, I think, for me. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah, because would you call any of these movies particularly frightening?
No, I would not. I'm sure they were in the day. Some of them were. But definitely by today's standards, they're very mild.
Yeah, absolutely. And this movie's got some frightening moments, and it's got some good plot points. I think when the two army officers are rescuing the boys in the sewer, and he gets crushed by the giant claw, that's a pretty shocking moment. And I think that would have been shocking even for audiences currently, as opposed to all audiences of yesteryear who would have found that particularly horrifying. It still does a good job of telling the story through that and having those horror moments, but movies of the 1950s did not rely on jump scares.
Right.
How do you feel about jump scares in film?
Oh, for watching modern films, I love a good jump scare.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've gotten accustomed to them, you know, and so it, sometimes it's, we talk about watching a modern horror film and we're talking about, was there a lot of jump scares in it? Or, no, there wasn't very many jump scares in it. So.
Mm-hmm. Almost as a, like the hallmark of the horror movie. Right. It is the thing that helps us determine whether a movie is really scary or not.
Right.
And with those come, obviously, discussions about like soundtracks and
right.
The ways that the film is accompanied to encourage or to support those jump scares. But I don't necessarily find a lot of contemporary horror to be as effective at storytelling as the 1950s horror. And I feel like the part of that is because the 1950s, 1960s, the Universal monster movies, they had to be able to tell a convincing story first. Whereas modern horror, they're suffering from the saturation of all of the different types of stories that have already been told. Everything is referential. And also, they have to rely on jump scares to convey the horror. They don't get to just tell a simple story.
Right, yeah.
Are there any modern horror movies, though, that you can think of that sort of mesh well with these sort of classic horror movies, or that harken back to these that you would gravitate towards?
Well, I mean, I think I've seen some, you know, like Van Helsing with Hugh Jackman. I mean, I like that. It was dark.
Gothic.
And it had all of our characters in it. Well, you know, Wolfman, you know, Frankenstein, and we had the Van Helsings in it. So, yeah, something like that. Even League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, was pretty neat, too, because it did kind of a good job of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde character in it, and an invisible man and that sort of thing.
Yeah. If you had to pick a go-to of the old school horror movies, what would you pick? Like, what's your go-to horror movie? And you don't have to have an answer.
You know, one that I really like of the Universals is The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr. I don't know, I just really like that movie. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, but with the Frankenstein, there was the Frankenstein movie, there was the Son of Frankenstein, there was the House of Frankenstein, which was the House of Dracula, and those were all Universal movies. But the Wolfman, he just kind of got his one shot at it. Well, he did get to come back in Evan Costello Meet Frankenstein. So.
Right, yeah. Without the Wolfman, he was sort of, or without that in the title, often he was an ancillary character, or he was a supportive role to the Frankensteins, right, or to the Dracula, or right, really even to the Abbott and Costello. He was a supporting character, but he got more time in the limelight, especially in, I think, the Abbott Costello, because he wasn't a villain. He was just a more complicated character that not only recognized that he had the tendencies of a villain because he would transform into this wolf, but he was fully self-aware and made active efforts to contain
right, that. Didn't want to be bad.
Yeah, he didn't want to be bad versus, you know...
Yeah, Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Who,
Dracula needs it.
Yeah, Dracula needs it. Frankenstein is just kind of a mindless...
Right.
Yeah. Hulking villain, which I think is kind of funny to think about with this movie. Coming back to ants, obviously, they're kind of these Frankenstein-esque replications, because they're just these massive hulking horrors that we can think of as mindless that are just constantly approaching, but they're also a part of this, I think, wave of irradiation. And, like,
right,
the giant irradiated ants that also affected, of course, the spiders in Eight-Legged Freaks. It's always about radiation.
Right. Atomic bomb tests.
And that was the reason that the ants became this way, is because there were radiation or atomic bomb testings in New Mexico.
Right.
And the radiation from those caused the ants to mutate, of course.
Right.
Don't you think that with this being 1954 and being so close to World War II, that had a pretty significant impact on the way that radiation kind of played into these films?
Yeah.
And the way that it created monsters.
Right. And no, I think definitely it can, because when I was growing up and in grade school in the 60s, we had Geiger counters, you know? I mean, we had Geiger counters, and I don't know if they have Geiger counters in schools now, but you could always get your hands on one. We'd take it outside and go around the playground with Geiger counters, seeing what we could find. It was radioactive. So, it was a real thing to us. So I think that brought a scare element into it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a particular fascination with what radiation does, because adjacently radiated Superman, right? So radiation in American media creates a lot of superheroes who get their powers from mutation, or radioactive spider bites like Spider-Man. But then it also has the capability of creating these monstrous figures. And if you take a look at Japan, Godzilla especially, like old versions of Godzilla, because that's been retconned so many times, or reconnected to this idea of an ancient natural horror that has just been slumbering, versus original interpretations of it, which were, this was a lizard creature that was mutated by radiation, which is especially relevant after World War II. So, yeah, the use of radiation as the vehicle for telling this story comes back time and time again. Do you think that for this, it kind of kicked off that era? This really was known as the first big bug feature in films. Do you think that this sort of set a precedence for the way that a lot of kaiju movies that came after it were affected by?
Yeah, I do too. I mean, we're going to tarantula, something similar. But in tarantula, we weren't talking about puppets. It was more like it was a real tarantula, and they, what's that method you call it? Where they make it's small, but it...
Oh, forced perspective.
Forced perspective, yeah.
Yeah. And they'll have an actual tarantula kind of like wandering around a play field or a made field
it looked real.
And I think that it's funny. This ends with Dr. Medford saying, "When man entered the atomic age, he opened the door to a new world." Right?
Yeah.
Which, very reflective of the fact that this film inspired a lot of films afterwards, but I think that that adage also has played into the way that a lot of horror movies have treated science and innovation, which is that science always goes bad at the end. Something always happens that creates some sort of more impending threat or terror. And especially, this made me also think of The Mist. Because the idea of The Mist, one of the things that the soldiers say to the people in the grocery store in The Mist is that they opened a door. They thought they were opening a window to look into another world, but they opened a door through which the mist came. And I don't think it's a coincidence that all of the horrifying creatures in The Mist are insect-like.
Right.
And you are also a fan of Alien. And the Alien movies, the Xenomorph, I think, has a lot of similarities to insect creatures and almost to ants in a lot of ways. Ants and kind of scorpion-like, but they have this exoskeleton and extra mandibles and all of those things. So the way that these big bug movies, which took something that was inherently terrestrial and made it alien seeming, impacted the way that future media also thought about what would be alien. Even looking at Starship Troopers,
right?
Which are also an insect-like race of of villains that right. I think can be loosely connected to this film yeah. as well. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts?
Whatever. whatever you think.
So, you've listened to the podcast before. I am going to do very little editing on this actual episode. Because I think that we're just having such a fluid conversation.
Yeah.
Thinking about movies and the way that you watch movies, it's very different, I think, from the way that I watch movies, which is the two frames are entertainment and analysis. And I find it hard now, especially having done the podcast for 5 seasons, we're at 95 episodes, to watch a movie without the framework of I'm analyzing this movie to watch it, to talk about it later, has impacted the way that I still view movies. But you still largely watch, and you watch a lot of movies for enjoyment. Have you noticed over the years the way that you have watched movies? Has it changed at all, or do you still find that you watch movies?
No, I think I watch them still the same way I always have. Yeah, with enjoyment. And I can watch the horror sci-fi movies over and over again. With no problem.
Which is another rare thing. It seems like a lot of modern audiences will watch once and then be done.
Yeah.
But you've always watched movies several times, and I've always watched movies several times because of course, living in your home.
Yeah, you had to.
I was forced to watch the same movies over and over again. The first movie I can remember ever watching, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park, we watched that a lot. Yeah.
Probably the first movie. Another kaiju movie, but without the kaiju, because they're just dinosaurs.
Right.
The entertainment value hasn't been lost on you, but do you find yourself still excited to see modern horror?
Oh yeah, if it's done right. Yeah, if it's something that's good. We went and saw the Pope's Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Parker, my grandson, and we enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean it was something different. It was fresh. It was different. Fresh. It was good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Do you find that the way that you find which films you want to watch has changed at all, too? Because growing up in the 60s and 70s, watching scary movies, I would imagine, is much more of the theater experience rather than the home video experience. Do you think that horror is better suited for the theater, or do you think that it still works with contemporary horror in the home setting? Do you like going to the theater, or do you prefer watching things at home?
Oh, I prefer watching things at home now. Yeah, and it's always been that way. I mean, once we were able to, once VHS came on, or became available, and we could buy these movies to watch them whenever we wanted, you know, that just changed things quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when you go into where I keep my media, there's, well, I don't have the DVD copies, but there's the Blu-ray copies, there's mm-hmm. the DVD copies, and they're the same things. It's, I keep buying them, and then I have many digital copies of the same horror movies. Mm-hmm. So,
coming back to them kind of several times
as
the media style evolves.
And Universal's really good about re-releasing things over and over again.
Absolutely. Well, they need the cash.
Yeah.
With the way that movies have changed, too, the way that as media comes out, right, it is highly commercialized now. And you have incidences of clips from commercials going viral, like the way that people discovered Megan, the serial killer doll kind of horror movie, was through the commercials. But I imagine that the experience when you were younger was different. You couldn't really go into that many movies really knowing what it was about beforehand.
Right. No, it was very limited. I saw very few movies as a child at the theater. I don't know that I can name any that I saw. Maybe a Disney film. maybe Swiss Family Robinson or something like that. Mm-hmm. But most everything that I saw was on, you know, a late night television. They had, you know, spook shows at 10:30 on Friday and Saturday nights, and that's what we stayed up and watched.
And don't you think it's different too that those were often like curated experiences, because there were people who were working at those television studios that were choosing what things were going to be on the air. So, so you were much more reliant on the critics and the way that people would actually present media, as opposed to now, where we're very much spoiled for choice, with the deluge of horror movies that come out. How do you pick which ones you are interested in watching? What grabs you scrolling through Netflix?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question, because I do look at a lot of them, and I just go right by them. But I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm looking for. But unfortunately, if I'm scrolling through Netflix, I'm looking for an old movie, and there's none there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all Netflix originals or real modern horror movies and stuff. It's not a place to go for nostalgia or for old films.
Right, and that's not to say that some of the Netflix movies aren't well done or aren't great horror movies. It's just the way that we find and experience media has changed so significantly from very limited selection, and so in that limitation your experience is broader because you don't have the luxury of choice, versus now where we're oversaturated with choices. And so it makes it, to me, more likely that I'm going to gravitate towards the thing that I know rather than the new movie that I don't know. Because I think that sometimes you can feel like your time has been wasted, don't you think?
Right. Well, and I rely on you and your sister Erin telling me, hey, Dad, have you seen this movie? It's really good.
Yeah.
Midnight Mass was something you told me about on Netflix, and I watched that, and the Dracula Netflix series. And I both those movies I really enjoyed. And Erin has told me some movies too that's on Netflix, and she knows that I would like them just because of she knows me.
So you get the luxury of having two children that very much enjoy horror, and can give you the inside scoop,
especially on the new movies.
Especially on the new movies, which is hard. To find sometimes. So. Do you have any other closing thoughts about horror movies in general? Anything that you want to say to the listeners of the podcast?
No, just watch the old black and white movies, the old horror movies, the old science fiction movies.
If you had to pick the one, if you had to choose the one horror movie that you think every person should see, what horror movie is it?
Good thing you can edit this out. It's hard to say. What do you think I should say?
That's up to you.
Maybe
that is a hard. There's a desert island kind of quality.
Yeah,
to
because
that
there's so many. When you asked me earlier about favorite, and I said, well, maybe the Wolfman, because you know I like the torment that Lon Chaney Jr. has whenever he plays that character. You know, I just like the storyline. But it is similar to Frankenstein and Dracula and The Invisible Man. You know, I really couldn't say. I would just, if I had to pick, if you said Desert Island, I would just want like a Universal box set with all my movies in it.
I think that is a fully justified answer. Well, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the podcast.
Oh, glad to be here.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Matt.
And this is Matt's dad.
And we'll see you next week with another episode.
Check out all the podcasts brought to you by Redwood Sound Labs. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you live a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror movie enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project.